Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There is, by my estimation, no greater champion of freedom in that war than our first guest. He is Andy McCarthy, a former federal prosecutor turned pundit, turned television star, turned best-selling author and columnist, a man of many parts, all of them performed with great effect, I'm very pleased to say, on behalf of America and our freedoms and our people. Andy has just been one of the star attractions at a most important hearing conducted by Senator Ted Cruz in the Senate Judiciary Oversight Subcommittee yesterday. And we've arranged to have two segments with him to talk a bit about it and one other matter that Andy's been very actively involved in, Benghazi, this day. It's very much in the news as well. But Andy, first of all, let me say how deeply grateful I am to you for taking a few minutes to talk about all of this. The hearing that had as a title an homage to you, as best I can tell, Willful Blindness. The title of your first book, Willful Blindness, A Memoir of the Jihad. Welcome back, sir. Good to have you.
Frank, thanks so much for the kind words. And the only thing I lament is that all these years later, we're still talking about willful blindness, which is something I, as I write about in the book, first detected when jihadists declared war on the United States by bombing the World Trade Center in 1993. So it's an awfully long time, especially in light of the struggle we're in and the number of attacks we've endured, that we're still talking about the same problem.
Yeah. Well, and if anything, I fear it's gotten worse even than it was in your time, because there's now so much more evidence that this is a misbegotten and reckless approach to a very serious danger. Give us a little bit of the scene, if you would, Andy. Who all testified along with you at Senator Cruz's hearing yesterday?
From our perspective, I tried to lay out the importance of ideology to the threat and the how insane it is, both factually and legally, to hold that because ideology has constitutional protection in the sense that you can't be indicted for having beliefs, it's just ridiculous to say that it can't trigger investigations. It has to trigger investigations.
It has to.
You know, I think Zudi brought out the importance of Islamic reform and the idea that we ought to be empowering pro-American, pro-liberty, pro-Western Muslims instead of taking our cues from what really ought to be labeled a terrorist organization, which is the Muslim Brotherhood.
Sworn enemies of this country, in fact.
Yeah. Haney was very effective, I think, in showing what's happening to our intelligence product on the government side. So I thought we covered the gamut pretty well. But, you know, the fact of the matter is we ought to pause over intelligence whenever we talk about it in connection with this war, because unlike the traditional war, where you have national armed forces facing off against each other, I don't mean to minimize the importance of intelligence in that kind of a conflict, because, of course, it's important and it can be the difference between winning and losing. But in a terrorism conflict where you're dealing with an enemy that strikes in stealth and hides among civilian populations, the better to mass murder them, intelligence takes on a dimension of importance that I think even transcends its importance in a traditional national conflict.
Yeah, which you have called Sharia supremacism, really, and I think that's an extraordinarily powerful and accurate term for it. There was one other in the white hat category who was also testifying, Chris Gaubatz. Remind us his story.
Yeah, he now works at an outfit called Understanding the Threat, with a fellow by the name of John Gondolo, who's also a terrific American patriot. And what they have vigorously, tirelessly tried to do is bring home to the American people the connection between the Sharia supremacist ideology and the threat against us, which includes not only violent jihadism, but a broader civilizational threat, which in some ways is more insidious and more threatening. Chris Gavotz has a very interesting story to tell because he actually infiltrated some of the Muslim Brotherhood tentacles in the United States, CARE in particular, I believe. But
undercover, indeed.
Yeah, so I think, you know, he showed how it worked. It was a good collection of people.
Now, of course, you weren't the only witnesses. The Democrats selected three, and I'd like you just to mention who they were and what their contributions, such as they were, to this important hearing and its topic.
They had a woman by the name of Farana Kira, who is the president and executive director of an outfit called Muslim Advocates, which really is the, I think it's the intellectual, legal, and advocacy backbone of the Obama administration's determination to disconnect ideology from an ideological threat. So I think she's kind of in charge of the Willful Blindness headquarters. And added to that was a guy by the name of J. Richard Cohen from the Southern Poverty Law Center. I'm still a little bit puzzled about what his contribution was. And not to say that what he had to say wasn't interesting, but I just think that the comparison that was drawn between other types of extremism and Islamic extremism is kind of beside the point, because nobody on our side is arguing that we shouldn't be troubled by violence which is fueled or motivated by any form of extremism. But the fact that you can have it's kind of like the logic that I would compare to his position, I go back to my prosecutor's experience. I mean, can you imagine if we decided not to do mafia cases on the theory that, well, you know, we shouldn't single out Italian organized crime because there's all kinds of organized crime. There's Chinese gangs, there's Irish gangs, there's black gangs. So his position kind of is that we shouldn't, you know, we shouldn't single out for attention the threat that is most immediate and most deadly to the United States, because other groups can be extreme too. And I just don't, to me, that's a complete non sequitur.
No, it's such a powerful metaphor, and really illustrates the absurdity, not to say the obscenity of the work of the SPLC, I have to say. Andy, lastly, there was a former FBI agent by the name of Michael German from something called the Brennan Center. What was his contribution to this?
You know, the Brennan Center is a, to my mind, a hard left outfit that sort of postures itself as centrist and pragmatic and sensible. Mr. German is a former FBI agent, so he gives the patina of law enforcement credibility to their position that's quite similar, actually, to the Southern Poverty Law Center's position, that it's a mistake to single out for attention Sharia supremacist extremism, because there can be other types of extremism too. And I think the more, what crystallized to me in his testimony was this similarly ridiculous concept that people are recruited and inspired to terrorism not by particular ideologies, but because of, you know, their economic conditions, because of the enticements of particular organizations. There just seems to be, what I regard to be a hard-headedly conscious avoidance of the fact that there is a particular ideology that is rooted in Scripture that results in both incitement by very authoritative Sharia supremacist jurist figures, like the guy I prosecuted years ago, the blind sheikh, and that this toxic combination results in terrorist attacks and is representative of a broader attack on Western civilization. There are people who simply don't want to come to grips with that, whether they think it's because we're overstating what threat is, or they see the reaction to the threat to be more dangerous than the threat itself, or at least they've convinced themselves of that. Whatever the reason, there just seems to be a determination to purge the connection between ideology and violence.
Yeah, and it seemed Michael German really was a sort of the poster child for that. Andy, we have to pause for a moment. When we come back, I want to talk about the official testimony that didn't happen. That and more with the great Andy McCarthy right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. According to the New York Times, President Obama said during a rare visit to the CIA to discuss the second phase in the battle against ISIS on April 13th, that the U.S.-led coalition had momentum against ISIS and that ISIS fighters realize their cause is lost. But the previous day, the New York Times ran a story with the headline, ISIS expands reach despite military and financial setbacks, noting that although ISIS has suffered losses on the ground in Iraq and Syria, it has expanded its presence in northern Africa, Afghanistan, and Europe. There also has been little progress in stopping ISIS's efforts to recruit homegrown terrorists worldwide. The president is in denial about the threat from ISIS. His trip to the CIA, which should have occurred 5 years ago when the violence broke out in the Middle East, was little more than a publicity stunt. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. Andy McCarthy is in the house. We couldn't be more pleased to say the star of a very important hearing. And I want to just say right out of the box how much I appreciate Senator Cruz leading on this. I think in some ways this was the most important hearing since 9/11 in terms of congressional oversight and really trying to dig into what on earth is going on with respect to government policy towards known enemies of this nation, including notably the Muslim Brotherhood operating with impunity, not just inside our country, but inside our government. And Andy, again, thanks for your leadership in this area in so many ways.
Frank, I think that's so right, and I'd encourage people, the Judiciary Committee actually has the hearing up on its website. People who didn't get a chance to see it may find it interesting.
Good. And I understand that there was an invitation extended to administration witnesses to participate in this hearing, and yet they didn't. What is up with that? And is there going to be some official testimony provided, do you think, in the near future?
Yeah, there were two important administration witnesses who were invited, and I think it was very disappointing that they chose not to attend. We were supposed to hear from the Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Justice Department's National Security Division, John Carlin, and also the FBI's National Security Branch Chief, Michael Steinbach. And evidently, although the hearing was noticed a couple of weeks ago, they announced at the last minute that they weren't going to come. The Democrats on the committee tried to spin that as an availability thing, but it was clear that they had plenty of notice. They also tried to spin it as how can you dare bring these important guys in to testify when they're out doing really important work like investigating the Orlando case. And I found that, personally, I thought that was not only silly, but in a way offensive because, my own experience was I was responsible for some pretty important investigations, too, in my time. And when a district court told me that my presence was needed, I made sure I got to where I was, directed to be. So I just think it's fatuous to say that, supervisors who aren't doing the on the ground scut work of investigations can't come into the United States Congress, the United States Senate, and explain to the people's representatives what is happening with the investigative agencies that the people fund.
I understand that the Judiciary Committee in the Senate may, however, get an official administration spokesman who should be a pretty useful target for the kind of inquiries that Senator Cruz engaged in yesterday. Who would that be?
Yeah, I understand that on Thursday, I believe it is, Frank, the full committee will hear testimony from Jay Johnson, who was the head of the Department of Homeland Security, cabinet-level official, who will have a lot to say, I imagine, about the government's, the Obama administration's, what passes for its counterterrorism strategy, countering violent extremism, which the, even though the Homeland Security Department is not doing the big terrorism investigations, the FBI is in charge of things like the Orlando investigation. Homeland Security has had a lot to do about the with the framework of the Obama counterterrorism.
Does this rise to the level of malfeasance, in your judgment, in terms of willfully refusing to know what there is to know? Our colleague Steve Coughlin calls it a catastrophic failure of, you know, professional responsibility. What do you think?
I believe it is. I think it's malfeasance. I think it's what I wrote about in my book on impeachment, Faithless Execution. It's what the framers would have called maladministration, and of the type, I think, that arises to a profound abuse of power in the nature of an impeachable offense. That said, Frank, you know, sometimes I think we're living in a different country than we think we're living in, because, you know, I see the president's approval rating is over 50, and nobody seems to be upset except for, you know, the usual 10 or 15 minutes of whining after a terrorist attack occurs, and why aren't we doing more? And then we kind of go back to business as usual. So I'm at a loss to understand it.
Andy, before we run entirely out of time, let me quickly ask you about another subject, which is really part of that legacy and part of this larger willful blindness. We have the report of the Benghazi Select Committee out yesterday, the minority views the day before, an important codicil to him by Jim Jordan and Michael Pompeo, the Citizens Committee on Benghazi coming out today. Give us your takeaway from all of this about what we now know was going on there and the implications for today as well.
Well, I think it's a very disappointing committee report. For the reasons I hate to say that I predicted all along, which is that the committee was, and I don't mean to say this as to all the committee, because I think people like Jordan and Pompeo were really heroic in this, trying to push for the truth. We didn't get basic answers to questions. We had very few public hearings to hold public officials accountable. And I think there's a lot of question why that happened. But in the main, the report does show some really shocking derelictions of duty, particularly by President Obama and Secretary Clinton before, during, and after the Benghazi attack. And as we at National Review called for yesterday, I think there really needs to be a reckoning based on the misconduct that was shown.
Andy, and in particular, one of the things, and again, we'll discuss this with Daniel, but the failure to really get at what was the policy behind our being in Benghazi. But I'd like to focus in on something else with you, because it speaks to this malfeasance, and that is this practice of Hillary Clinton personally, but the administration more generally, Ben Rhodes at the White House, and Susan Rice and Huma Abedin and Rashad Hussein at the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, the whole lot of them misleading, knowingly, intentionally, deliberately, maybe misleading isn't strong enough, lying to the American people about the idea that there was a video that precipitated this attack. What are we to make of that? And what kind of accountability should now be in order?
Well, in a better time, Frank, in a more sensible time, these people would long ago have been impeached. This is one of the most impeached and removed. I mean, this is one of the most shocking derelictions of duty, one of the most shocking and disgraceful episodes in the history of the United States. And I don't use that description lightly, but when you not only create an irresponsible threat to people who serve heroically overseas on behalf of the United States, you put them in harm's way. As the threat intensifies, you actually reduce their security, knowing that people inside your department are saying that you've assigned people to a death trap. And then when the inevitable happens, not only do you not lift a finger to help Americans under siege, but you spend your energy concocting a fraud to play on the American people about what caused the attack. I don't know of anything that anybody in the United States has ever been impeached for that was anything close to the kind of abuse of power and dereliction of duty that happened in the Benghazi episode. It's a disgrace.
It is a disgrace. It is a scandal. And even if they were not removed from office, they certainly should be considered unfit to serve in any future position, let alone, in the case of Mrs. Clinton, as the commander-in-chief. Andy McCarthy, again, your books, Willful Blindness, Faithless Execution, The Grand Jihad, and so many others, your writings at National Review and PJ Media, your appearances at Fox and elsewhere, and needless to say, here, are so deeply appreciated. Keep up all that good work, my friend. Come back to us again soon. Daniel Horowitz joins us next, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Another day, another act of jihad. Fortunately, even as Islamists were blowing up Turkey's biggest airport yesterday, the first serious congressional oversight hearing since 9/11 was illuminating why such acts of Islamic holy war have been obscured, denied, and arguably enabled by the U.S. government. Senate Judiciary Subcommittee Chairman Ted Cruz deserves great credit for impaneling a group of Muslim and non-Muslim patriots and individuals who are associated with or enablers of the Muslim Brotherhood's stealthy influence operations to discuss how such subversive forms of jihad have helped take down our first lines of defense against them. Obama administration witnesses declined to participate. We can only hope that in light of what was uncovered yesterday, in the way of the deep penetration of our government and official malfeasance, Senator Cruz will convene another hearing and, if necessary, compel government testimony via subpoena. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. I couldn't be more pleased to say, joined for an extended conversation with one of the men who I've come to admire greatest among his generation, particularly in terms of his clarity of vision, his articulateness, his passion, and his commitment to principle, conservative principles, that is. He is Daniel Horowitz, the senior editor at a marvelous publication these days called Conservative Review. He is also the author of a new book, Stolen Sovereignty: How to Stop Unelected Judges from Transforming America. We'll talk about that with him and more in a moment. But Daniel, first let me say welcome. It's good to have you back, and thanks so much for giving us a bit of your time today.
Definitely good to be with you, and let me tell you, there is not enough time to go through everything in this news cycle. Boy, is it busy the last couple of weeks.
It is, but we're going to do our level best to see what we can in three segments. Let's start with the topic that I was discussing a moment ago with Andy McCarthy, who, of course, participated in the hearing, but I'd love to get your perceptions of what Senator Cruz was trying to do and the extent to which it was accomplished.
Sure. You know, to me, the biggest takeaway was the Democrats. I was sitting there watching the hearing. I watched all 3 hours of it, but it's amazing to watch the Democrats espouse the very view that Cruz was accusing the government of harboring when they were covering up all references to Islamic terror and jihad when investigating terrorism. They would illustrate his point by talking about extremism, and many of them said that they see absolutely no difference between what is going on in Islam versus environmentalists, right-wing extremists, or anything. See nothing, hear nothing. It just amazed me, both from the Democrat members, from their witnesses. This is what we're up against. And I'm thinking, even one generation ago, even a half a generation ago, you didn't have a Democrat Party like this. That really amazed me. You know, beyond that, I think there was one very powerful moment, in this entire hearing. We had our buddy Zudi Yasser there, one of the true moderate Muslims that, the Democrats always like to talk about, moderate Muslims. He always said it. He said a line from his father: "When you point at the moon, the idiots look at the finger," and that is what our political class is doing. They want to focus on guns. They want to focus on generic extremism, on poverty, and even Republicans. They'll focus on Islamic civil wars in the Middle East. They'll focus on ISIS. That was another thing that really stuck out to me. The problem of Islamic terrorism is ISIS. ISIS was created in 2013. We've had the problem of the modern era of pan-Islamic jihadist movement for at least 3-4 decades.
And let me ask you, Daniel, one of the things that I was impressed by and I think was a singular contribution of this hearing was that while the talk remains primarily of radical Islamic terrorism, there was clearly a record made, an appreciation of the danger that is posed to us by what I think of as kind of a pre-violent jihadism, the work of the Muslim Brotherhood specifically, which was represented here, let's be clear, by this gal who runs the Muslim Advocates, Farhana Kara, and by its apologists on the left, the Southern Poverty Law Center and Brennan Center. These characters, I think, were, in denial, obviously, about that. But the record seemed to be pretty clearly made that that is a whole nother dimension to this problem, and one that has had a profound effect, it seems, on U.S. government thinking, policies, and programs, for that matter.
Sure, and there were some distractions there, but I do think that was the main point that Senator Cruz wanted to get across, with Zudi, with Andy McCarthy and some others there. Obviously, Phil Haney testified about his experience as a subject matter expert and connecting the dots. And that's the biggest thing that I think a lot of Americans don't hear about enough. They hear about terrorism in a vacuum, as if it just comes out of nowhere. And when you have individuals in Western society in America, one after another being arrested for attempting to go over and fight for a foreign terror group, for plotting a domestic terror attack, it doesn't come out of nowhere. They have friends, family members, community leaders, neighbors, obviously centering around their mosque, that is cultivating that climate. And that's what nobody wants to talk about. I was jumping out of my seat when Senator Klobuchar, the Democrat from Minnesota, and several others were extolling the good law enforcement work in the state. Look, see how many people we were able to prosecute. We successfully did it. I was thinking, well, exactly, that's our point. The Somali community in Minneapolis is cultivating that climate. We have so many. They were almost bragging about the amount of prosecutions they had. Well, that's nice, but where does it stem from? And, what they didn't say is the U.S. attorney from Minnesota, Andrew Luger, said that they have a major terror recruitment problem in that community. So that's the question. ISIS is the latest cool terror group on the block that was created 3 years ago. You have Al-Qaeda, you got Hezbollah, you got Hamas and the Taliban, you have all these groups, but the glue that holds them together is adherence to Sharia and the desire to establish Sharia rule over the globe. And what is kind of almost like the Organizing for America street organizer version of Islamism is the Muslim Brotherhood. They are what rears these individuals into this mentality. Another amazing thing was when Lindsey Graham asked that Muslim Brotherhood sympathizer on the panel about that Fort Pierce mosque, how is it that you could have in one place you happen to have two terrorists, one suicide bomber and then the Orlando terrorist, and they didn't want to answer, totally clueless. She said that there's not a single imam in this country that supports Al-Qaeda. And that's the point. There are dozens of them. There are perhaps hundreds of them that support that ideology. Yeah, maybe they themselves won't go out and strap a bomb onto their shoulders. But the point is, we have to see where this is coming from. And certainly as it relates to immigration, where you don't have to worry about any civil liberties because you don't have a right, an affirmative right to enter the country, we don't need to just weed out those that we think are going to strap bombs on themselves, which you could seldom see ahead of time. We need to weed out those who will hate America, who will hate our values.
Which is implicit in and very much the leitmotif of Sharia and the agenda of those who are coming here, or frankly, some of those who are here have to embrace as well. And whether it's strapping on the bomb, as you say, Daniel Horowitz, or whether it's fostering more migration of people who may do that or may simply help provide funding for the jihadists, or whether it's people like the Muslim Brotherhood who are about the business of subverting us from within by our hands, as they say. This is really the heart of the problem. Hey, Daniel, we're going to have to pause here in a moment, but let me just toss to you a sort of a segue to how we have seen this deferring to Sharia, for example, Sharia blasphemy restrictions, evident in the response to the Benghazi attack. Talk a little bit about the video and what we've learned in the course of the various reports that have now been released.
Well, you know, one of the interesting things that Phil Haney said in his testimony is that you're seeing the Muslim Brotherhood manifest on two sides of the coin. It's obviously on the Homeland Security side, scrubbing our lexicon and our the ability to investigate anything that's related to Islam. But then it's also foreign policy as well. Notice how to the extent that there's coherence in Obama's foreign policy, the one element of consistency is that every single policy that he employs comports with the Muslim Brotherhood agenda. And you saw it in Egypt and you saw it in Libya as well. To this day, Obama is not supporting the Haftar-led government in the East that actually wants to go after the Muslim Brotherhood and the terrorists. He's supporting this government in Tripoli that the UN and the EU created that brought in the Libyan dawn. So that was going on for several years, and that gets back to Benghazi. Because it was see no evil, hear no evil. He was actually working for them.
Let's pause for just a second and come back to that point. More with Daniel Horowitz of Conservative Review right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back in what is a very important conversation with one of the most important young national security and, well, conservative thinkers, writers, pundits in America. He is Daniel Horowitz. These days, a senior editor at Conservative Review, also the author of Stolen Sovereignty, How to Stop Unelected Judges from Transforming America. And I want to give you a chance to pick up on the sort of policy underpinnings of the Obama administration's, well, not simply how it's conducted itself in broad detail vis-a-vis Islamic supremacism, but how in particular it played out in the Benghazi episode.
Sure. You know, in the Benghazi episode, what bothered me most about the Republican, you know, version of this report, obviously the Democrat version was, again, see no evil, hear no evil. But in the Republican version, I would have liked them to delve into why we were there to begin with. Certainly of the tragic loss of life, the egregious cover-up, the lying about what caused it when the State Department actually saw what was going on in real time. And I think that much the committee did do a good job of connecting those dots. But really beforehand, why were they there? Why were we in Benghazi when no one else was there at that point? What were we doing? And
particularly with these two facilities, neither of which was adequately protected, and that was the case despite a lot of efforts on the part of those there saying we need to be better protected in the light of the dangers in the area.
Exactly. And to me, again, and not to minimize the loss of life and the lack of response, and you always want to investigate that. You know, sadly, once it's over, it's over. Not to echo Hillary's "what difference does it make," but it's kind of it's a one-off tragedy. But in terms of our national security policy, our foreign policy, there's long-term implications that are still relevant in that what Obama is doing in the Middle East is he is training, arming, and using our special forces to go and work with our enemies. He's doing that all over the Middle East. And I just had a report out of Conservative Review about what was going on in Jordan and Syria with the Syrian rebels and all these guns that went on the black market and went in the hands of individuals that wound up killing Americans. And
so-called Timber Sycamore, I think, was the name of the program under which this was done.
That's right, all these clandestine names. And Libya was the same thing. What Obama was doing there, allegedly, was working with Muslim Brotherhood-inspired Islamist groups and then running a gun-running operation to get the arms out of the al-Qaeda in Libya that, you know, overthrew Gaddafi because that was over with, to the Syrian rebels, so to speak. And that's what Ambassador Stevens was there to begin with. Another interesting data point in the report is that they noted to the extent there was some help escaping, from the area, it was Gaddafi-backed individuals that helped them. None of the groups that they dealt with in Benghazi that we were supporting and training lifted a finger, and indeed many of them were part of the attack.
Yeah, some of them were the shooters, indeed. Does the President of the United States not understand that's what he's doing, or does he have a sympathy for, if not the violent jihadists perhaps, but certainly the Islamic supremacists or Sharia supremacism, as Andy McCarthy calls it, that animates them?
You know, I think there's two things. In a general sense, the last thing you said is very true, that it stems from Obama's anti-colonial upbringing, that he feels that, you know, they've gotten a bad rap in the Middle East and North Africa from the colonial days, and they have valid grievances. I mean, he said this in his L.A. Times op-ed a couple of years ago, the word legitimate or valid grievances, something to that effect. He says, look, I obviously oppose your tactics. I remember during one of the flare-ups between Israel and Hamas, he said Hamas acted irresponsibly. And the idea was, well, you know, yeah, you got legitimate grievances, but, you know, maybe we should put you on administrative leave. You killed a couple too many civilians. You know, go after the Israeli army. That's okay. But I mean, and that's his
point. Or we'll work with the part of your team that isn't directly implicated in those attacks, as though there's a dime's worth of difference.
And that's the point. The suit terrorists. He's all for the suit terrorists, and that's where the Muslim Brotherhood comes in. The Muslim Brotherhood understands that. And this is an old tactic of the left. I call it the Goldilocks mentality, where they're able to set themselves up as the moderate mainstream view. They always find some straw man to point to that is so-called more extreme. So in this case, everything is ISIS. And again, I don't want to minimize the problem of ISIS, but in many respects, in the long-term war, it's a straw man. It's 3 years old. I mean, you know, we dealt with the terrorism on a large scale in America since 1993, I mean, really before then. So they want to say, well, they're chopping people's heads off, so there's ISIS. The Muslim Brotherhood, it's out in the open. He generally believes they are moderate. He believes you can work with them. But the reality is they are the most dangerous head of the jihadist animal, because it's the subversion. And even al-Qaeda, notice how in their latest iteration of Inspire magazine, they talk about warning these so-called individual attackers in America not to attack anywhere where there's minorities or there are gay individuals. They understand American politics. They use our system against us. And that's what it is. And Obama is being played by that or willfully going along with it.
Daniel, one of the things that I think is at work here is that these guys aren't just sort of tumbling to the fact that they can use our system, use even our Constitution against us. They're being coached in how to do this by the left. As I mentioned in the hearing, you had the Southern Poverty Law Center, one of the great enablers of the jihadists. You had the Brennan Center, including in the person of a former FBI agent, by the way, actively enabling this sort of stealth jihad through their efforts in court and elsewhere to facilitate it. It's part of the challenge that we're facing, and you guys at Conservative Review do such a terrific job of trying to expose and hold people accountable for this kind of conduct. But it's perhaps the most toxic piece of this. It's not just the enemy without. It is the enemy within, and it happens to be of both the Islamist or Islamic supremacist or Sharia supremacist, whatever you wish to call it, stripe, but also people of the hard left who seem to have no difficulty making common cause with folks who would kill homosexuals, kill Jews, kill feminists, and a lot of other groups that are supposed to be, of their cohort, or at least that they supposedly admire so much.
They are being played like a fiddle. It's amazing. They are drinking out of the trough created by these Islamic groups. The thing people need to understand about the Islamists is what keeps them up at night, what they're thinking about in Raqqa or wherever they are, is not, Michael Johnson, your guy in the 75th Ranger Regiment 3 miles away that might kill them. They're thinking about our political leaders, are people in Hollywood, media figures. They have dossiers on them. They know who they are. They're fighting an information war, a propaganda war, because they understand that you can't beat the West. You're not going to beat the American military and invade America militarily, but they understand that if you study the intricacies of post-constitutional society in America, moral relativism in the West in general, you could use the system against them, dress up as minority, aggrieved minorities, civil rights activists, and you just get them eating out of your hand, and they do this every day.
They will actually help you, indeed. Dana, we have to pause for just one more moment. We'll be right back with our third segment with Daniel Horowitz of Conservative Review right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back for the final segment with Daniel Horowitz of Conservative Review. He is renowned, I believe, in conservative circles and increasingly elsewhere for his very thoughtful attention to the most important policy, in particular national security policy issues of our day. He's also the author of a great book, Stolen Sovereignty: How to Stop Unelected Judges from Transforming America. Daniel, you had a piece recently, there's so many that warrant our attention, but I want to particularly commend you for this one. It's entitled "Get Out of the Bunker, Conservatives: 8 Ways to Go on Offense Post Orlando." This appeared at Conservative Review on the 20th of June. Give us, if you would, a quick tour of the 8 specific initiatives that you would recommend, and maybe start with what the conservatives have been doing instead.
You know, everything in politics is unfortunately a binary choice. Life is a lot more complicated than that, but it's always made, are you pro or con this? And you either define that binary choice or you get defined by it. You become a victim of the narrative. Democrats right away came out and made this about guns. They made it about the object. And as absurd as we thought it was, they succeeded because you didn't have a counter narrative. Republicans just sat there and allowed, and you know, they conducted votes on it. Instead, they should have come out right away and said, are you for the Muslim Brotherhood or are you against the Muslim Brotherhood? Are you for open borders? Are you for building a fence? Are you for, as I'm just going down my list here, are you for exit entry visa tracking where we could track visas that you guys always say you're for? So let's vote on it right now. No vote, no break. Hey, hijack their hashtag. Like I said, I would have sat there on the House floor with Democrats protesting no vote, no break, no vote on this stuff. Where are the amendments? Republicans at least putting this out. There's one thing you say you can't get through a filibuster, you can't get through Obama's veto, but try to at least define the narrative. Why is there no vote on Syrian refugees as Obama is bringing in 1 to 300 per day now? For the remainder of the fiscal year.
Unvettable Syrian refugees, yeah. Well, and Daniel, this is made all the more outrageous because, of course, what the Democrats were doing by insisting that we talk about gun control was deflection. They could not stand having the debate be about, well, for example, the sorts of things you've mentioned, let alone that it is a deep-seated tenet of Sharia to kill homosexuals. In fact, it's been pointed out on my program and elsewhere that the only debate within Islam is what's the right way to kill them? You know, is it burning them alive? Is it hanging them? Is it throwing them off of high places? I mean, that should have been the subject of the debate. And as you say, whether it's defunding this cockamamie and downright dangerous, as the hearing yesterday showed in Senator Cruz's subcommittee, this dangerous program of so-called countering violent extremism, which is all one big deflection as far as I'm concerned. There was a lot to talk about, and instead, as you've pointed out, the Republicans actually voted to spend $50 million more to expand that program, and it's mistraining of our first lines of defense. What's up with that?
I mean, if you had to summarize everything that Obama has done on the homeland front, on just pursuing Islamic terror, it's the CVE agenda. That is the Muslim Brotherhood agenda to kind of jujitsu the direction of our counterterrorism towards focusing on where it is, to making it, to just throwing up hey, you know, I actually want to use the analogy given by that woman yesterday at the
Farhana Kara.
Yeah, Kara, that's right. She actually gave, she said, you know what, we shouldn't be focusing on this, on Islam. We should be focusing on CVE, because otherwise you're adding more hay to the needles. I was thinking, man, that's a perfect analogy. That's exactly what they're doing. They're throwing up chaos. Well, let's focus on animal rights terrorists, environmental terrorists, right-wing terrorists, and guns. So the gun control, that is part of the CVE agenda, again, because the Islamists understand American politics very well, and they understand that you sound very progressive and very intellectual, very thoughtful when you talk about gun control. So that's how immediately after this, look, even to the extent that you could deal with making any mass shooting about the weapon, but the notion you're going to make an Islamic terror attack when we have Europe where you can't own guns and these guys have automatic weapons, and they get them anyway, it's absurd, but they're able to do it. And instead of Republicans identifying the problem and going after Obama on this, they actually have a fake fight over whether to mention Islamic terror. And then they pass a bill validating and consummating his entire agenda of obfuscating any mention of Islamic terror and the CVE agenda. And it passed unanimously. I couldn't believe it.
Hey, but Daniel, I mean, one of the things that going back to the hearing again for a moment, that is so transparently obvious about this, I guess, now, but still isn't being adequately challenged by Republicans, is that we are encouraging, we are actually enabling the jihadists in our midst, to move from, I believe, that stealthy infrastructure building into the violent phase, the more they see us engaging in what they think of as submission. And it's hard to describe this as anything other than submission when we refuse to acknowledge the nature of the enemy, and particularly its guiding doctrine, Sharia.
And that's what concerns me. It's not just Democrats. Democrats are already just off the wall. They don't even want to recognize – notice yesterday another thing that came out. They didn't want to use the word radical Islam. I mean, it's not even – forget about saying there's inherent problems in the modern practice of Islam, but they didn't even want to recognize radicalism. They said, well, there's radical elements of every religion, every ideology, every group of people. But even Republicans, they focus on groups. They're obsessed about naming groups. They're obsessed with ISIS now, or at least Al-Qaeda and a couple others. It's not about that. Those are tactics that have arisen to promote the end goal. And the end goal is global domination of the world, of the infidel, as required by the Quran. You know, look, obviously you can have individual Muslims that, you know, kind of assimilate, don't want to deal with that. But those that firmly adhere to it, that is what they're practicing. So, you know, that's why when you say, well, the problem is ISIS. Well, yeah, I mean, there's going to be very few people that submit an application for a visa to immigrate to our country that you're going to find them with a card that says that they're a member of ISIS. But what many of them are is firm adherence to Sharia. They come here together with the Muslim Brotherhood-controlled mosque and curriculum in their schools. They cultivate that climate that brings that kinetic energy to that potential energy to kinetic energy to the radicalization phase and to the execution phase, where they take those views and act on them. And that's the thing. We can't look at the tactic or the outcome. It's the ideology behind it, and until we recognize it, we're going to continue repeating the same mistakes that frankly began in the Bush administration as well.
They did, and that's a little acknowledged aspect of this problem, of course, that the Republicans have been remiss at best and perhaps AWOL or complicit at worst going back to George W.
By the way, Frank, I don't know if you heard yesterday – I counted 5 times when Democrats or their panelists praised Bush. So that's not lost on them.
Not much in evidence on the campaign trail, needless to say. Daniel Horowitz, we have to leave it at that for the moment, but this is a subject we will return to, I hope, soon and often with you. Keep up all that good work, my friend, and do come back to us again, if you would, very soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.